things I announced in the title, but maybe I'll shift certain, well, maybe change the order of the things. So, and I have to start this talk with an apology because, as many of you know, I'm definitely not a physicist, and so I'll try to keep this talk kind of, I don't know, maybe interesting for at least some part of the physical audience. But you know, I can't promise that I will succeed in this. So, so roughly speaking, the structure of the talk will be the following. So, I'll talk about relation between two sides, and so there will be two. So, kind of. Very generally, on this side, I will have some kind of geometry, and here there will be. Well, I'll say what kind of geometry in a few minutes. Well, just a minute. Here will be sort of algebra representation theory, now a little bit more specifically, the geometry which will appear here, it will be. Moduli spaces. Oh, instantons in four dimensions. In well, certain particular moduli space of instantons. I'll say this more precisely a little later. And so there will be some kind of geometry of the spaces. So we'll, in particular, we'll start the cohomology. For example, this spaces. And here, well, I don't want to sort of say right now exactly what will appear, but what we're going to have is, roughly speaking, representation theory of certain. Current algebras, and so just examples of algebras that will appear, at least which could appear, so I don't know to what extent I'll have the time to talk about this, it's either affine Lie algebras, W algebras, and actually the main example will be this W algebras, and in a little bit more physical language, somehow this part is going to have is going to be related to four-dimensional supersymmetric quantum field theory and maybe some kind of deformations of this. So, and here we're going to have some two-dimensional conformal field theory. So the particular field theories that this thing is related to, in the simplest possible example, it will have to do with Liouville theory, or more generally, which what is called Todde field theory. And so some kind of a relation between these two things is what is called the AGT conjecture. So AGT is Alde Gayota Tichikawa conjecture. And so I don't think it's kind of, as far as I understand, relatively well understood what this conjecture is saying. So, of course, here, if we're talking about gauge theory. So we're talking about gauge theory, then there's some gauge group G which appears here. And if this gauge group is SU2, then it's kind of, at least for physicists, as far as I understand, it's more or less clear at least what the conjecture is saying. For general G, I don't think there's a clear formulation even in physical language. And definitely, so what I'm going to say can be thought of as a kind of rigorous formulation, but definitely not of the whole conjecture, but of some maybe corollaries of this conjecture. So somehow, I don't know how to rigorously mathematically formulate what this relationship between two quantum field theory, know that there's two quantum field theories in different dimensions, what it is actually saying, but it's supposed to have certain mathematical corollaries, and what I'm going to present can be thought of, at least should be thought of probably, as a as a corollary of this statement, which basically nobody knows what the statement is actually saying. Okay, so this is kind of a preview of what's going to happen. Now I want to sort of basically slowly introduce the main players here and here, and then just make a statement that these two things are related to each other. And maybe I should mention that everything I'm going to say is a joint work with Michael Finkelberg and Hiroko Nakajima. Okay, so this is kind of the abstract of the talk. So one important question I have is, I somehow from the schedule didn't really understand how much time I have. So how long am I supposed to talk? Well, how long can you bear? No, seriously, I mean, is it an hour and a half? All right, I need to know where to stop. Okay, so let me start on the geometric side. And so this is maybe all of this should be thought of part zero of the talk. And here I'm going to start with part one, which is going to be the moduli spaces in question. Now here, there's again some kind of, I would say, cultural difference between the mathematical school I'm coming from and what and how physicists usually think about this thing. So somehow there are various moduli spaces in mathematics which can be sort of thrown in two different languages. So one language is a language of differential geometry, and the other language is a language of algebraic geometry, complex geometry. And I basically come with a background of algebraic geometry. This is kind of this is the language where I feel comfortable. But the way these things naturally appear and say quantum field theory, this is actually in the language of differential geometry, which I feel much less comfortable about. So I'll now sort of say, I'll introduce them in both languages, but later on I will actually use the holomorphic language. So the moduli spaces are the following. So first of all, we're going to fix group G, and again, so the group G, there's again sort of question whether talking the language of differential geometry or complex geometry, because if you're talking the language of differential geometry, it should be compact group, like unitary group and so on. If you're talking the complex language, this should be complex group. So let me for a second talk about compact group, but later on I'm going to change the notation, and I will actually think about its complexification. So compact group, and I'll assume that this group is simple. So a good example I can think about is that G equal to SUN. And then I'm going to fix a number, natural number D, which is going to be greater or equal than zero. And to this thing, I'm going to associate certain moduli space, M, D, G. And this is the moduli space of, you can say G instantons, which is the same as solutions of Young-Mills equations. On R4, and they're supposed to be what is called framed, which means that basically they're fixed in some standard way at infinity. So somehow when you go to infinity in R4, somehow they should be fixed. And G is what is called the instanton number. And this is also the same mathematically. This also, so Young-Mills equations means that you consider a G bundle together with a certain connection, and this connection is supposed to satisfy a certain equation, which is called the Young-Mills equation. But G is the second Turing class of the bundle in question. So now the question is whether I have already lost most of the audience or not. So now in the holomorphic, what, as I said, so I actually prefer the holomorphic language. Holomorphic language. And actually, if you do things carefully mathematically, instead of talking about R4 is actually the way physicists usually talk about this, but actually, if you want to think, say things carefully mathematically, especially if you want to say this frame condition carefully, then it's better to work not with R4, but the four-dimensional sphere, and say that you have actually these things on the sphere, but with certain prescribed behavior near the pole. Now, in the holomorphic language, these things are the following, so let's GC be the complexification. Oh, G. So I'll later switch notation. In fact, I'll work always with the complexification. So I'll just, but for now, the complexification, for example, in this case, GC is going to be just the group SLM C. And then the same moduli space is, so it is known that the same moduli space can be thought of in the following way. This is the moduli space of holomorphic G bundles on the complex projective plane, for example, and with second Turing class equal to G. And there's an analog of this framing, and the analog of the framing is a trivialization at infinity. So somewhere, so you just write the projective plane as a union of ordinary plane and the projective line at infinity, and at infinity you want to trivialize everything. So this is the same space. This is kind of, you want a little lemma. Well, in fact, it's not a trivial lemma, but it's a kind of known thing. And so
can I just ask a question? So it's no mention of Young-Mills equations.
No, but this is general. It's called general. There's some theorem which is called the Uhlenbeck-Yau theorem, which says that in some big generality, whenever you have a complex scalar surface, there's a way to go between Young solutions of Young-Mills equations, holomorphic bundles. So in this case, this kind of precise statement that there's a kind of canonical isomorphism between these things. And so what is known about this? So this MDG is a
self-dual.
I'm sorry?
Self-dual.
Self-dual. Yes, I mean, I should have said this. So this MDG is a complex, what kind of structures does it have? First of all, it's a complex manifold. So, well, if you think about this in this language, then it's kind of pretty obvious should have a complex structure. In fact, it's hyperkeller, but it won't play any role in what I'm going to say. So dimension, its complex dimension is, well, its complex dimension is interesting. It's 2D H-check, where H-check is something which is called the something associated with the group G. So this is some number. It's called the dual Coxeter number. So maybe I'm not going to give a definition of this number, but let me just mention that if G is SLN or SUN, then H check is equal to N. But other than that, somehow, for other groups, it's kind of what this number is given the group is actually not completely obvious, but still this kind of one number associated to every such group. So it's complex manifold of this dimension. And what is going to be important for future is that it has a natural action. So from now on, I'm going to switch the notation. Maybe I should write it. So now I'm going to switch. So I'll, instead of, and G will always be actually denote the complexification. As a natural action of the group G times GL2C. And how does this action, how does it work? Well, this acts by changing the trivialization at infinity. And this just acts on CP2, preserving the line at infinity.
This G is now GC.
Yes. OK, so we get some space on which this group act. And so somehow, again, since this is a talk for physics, let me mention that somehow one idea of, I think, Nekrasov from 12 years ago was the following, that one should, well, what I'm going to say now is going to be a little bit imprecise, but I'll make it more precise, a little bit more precise later, that a rigorous mathematical way to define at least some quantities in supersymmetric gauge theory is by integrating certain, well, I'll write it and then I'll talk about this a little bit more for a few minutes, integrating certain equivariant, equivariant with respect to G across GL2 cohomology classes. On over, let's say, MTG. Well, and usually it should take their, and maybe taking the generating function. But the point is that somehow certain quantities, which usually in quantum field theory are somehow defined by means of certain divergent integrals, can be defined by sort of doing some kind of topology or intersection theory in the spaces. So I'll talk a little bit about equivariant cohomology in a minute. And in fact, in physics literature, this is also called, I mean, the fact that we can see the things equivariantly with respect to this GL2 group, this has to do with what is in physics literature called supersymmetric. I'm not going to say what it means, and the fact that it's not up to me probably to say what it means. Supersymmetric gauge theory in omega background. So you can think about this as a kind of some kind of deformation of the actual gauge theory, and you will see how numerically you will see how this works in a few moments. But basically, you can think about what we're going to do is some kind of deformation of the true gauge theory, and then so deformation means that everything will depend on some extra parameters, and then the kind of true gauge theory is usually recovered by sort of making these parameters go to infinity, sorry, or to zero. But usually, when you do this, you get some singularities, and you have to sort of cleverly say what how we actually take this load.
What is the omega standard?
It's not, well, it's not a question for me, actually. as I think as it very often happens, this is some kind of notation which just accidentally appeared in some computation, and then so I don't think there is any kind of big ideological reason for why this is omega and not something else.
But what does it represent? What you say it represents?
Frankly, I don't remember. But again, technically, what's going to happen here is that, for example, suppose you want to define a partition function of this theory. Now, when you write it, it's just it's known that somehow in supersymmetric gauge theory, you can localize the path integral in the space of instantons. But then still, the integrals you get are still divergent. And then, so how do you make a divergent integral convergent? You introduce some extra parameters. And then, so such as for generic values of the parameters, the integral is convergent. And this extra parameters, introducing this extra parameters is what actually means putting it in the micro background. And mathematically, it means that you work equivalently with respect to a certain bigger group. And then you are going to sort of recover the original thing by sort of trying to get rid of these parameters, which is actually usually a non-trivial task.
So you might call it regulated specific. Well,
yes, you can think about this as a kind of specific way to regularize, but as far as I understand, again, it's probably not a question to me, but as far as I understand, this theory somehow sort of nowadays exists in its own right, so somehow it's kind of, it exists not just as a way to regularize the original theory, but it's just the fact that you can define certain quantities which depend on more parameters than you usually thought is actually is considered to be a good thing and not a bad thing in some sense. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about, like I said, so the main, mathematically, the main object we're going to work with is certain cohomology, and so let me talk a little bit about various cohomologies that will appear in this talk. And so our goal, part two, this, what is the relevant cohomology? And so my kind of maybe pretty ambitious goal will be not to define, but at least to introduce, say something in general about the what is called equivariant intersection cohomology. But let me first talk about equivariant cohomology. Suppose that X is some space, it can be manifold or it can be, say, complex algebraic, right? The point is that it can be a singular space. So this some, it works in a very big generality of space with an action of, say, the group G. It can be, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same group that has already appeared, because we're actually going to apply it, I'll just denote it now also by G, but later we're going to apply this, say, product of G and GL2. This is some kind of sufficiently nice group, so G should be thought of as a complexification of a compact group, or in fact, it can be so compact, it can be compact group itself, compact, or complexification of compact. And this action, I mean, I'm not assuming anything about this action. For example, it can be a trivial action. So, what most people know is that now we have a space, it makes sense to consider its cohomology, say, with complex coefficients. But now, if you have an action of the group G, you can promote it to, there's a kind of better cohomology which you can define, namely, you can consider the equivariant cohomology. And the way you should be thinking about this, the equivariant cohomology is the cohomology of the quotient of the space by G. But the point is that the quotient can be something extremely bad, and you have to sort of define, so you have to, there's an extra work involved in how you define this. So if the action of the group is free, this is going to be literally the cohomology of the quotient. Otherwise, this is something relatively complicated, but let me just say that what is the kind of best example of a non-free action? Best example of non-free action is a trivial action. So let's consider the example when X is just a point and then automatically GX freely, GX trivially. And so what is the cohomology, equivariant cohomology of a point? Well, it turns out to be the following. So, well, let me first do an example when G is just C star or a circle. That, C star is a complexification of a circle. Then in this case, this is going to be just a polynomial. Well, it turns out this is just a polynomial ring in one variable where this variable has degree 2. And in general, this is going to be, OK, let me now introduce some notation. So when we have this group G, let T inside G be maximal torus. And so let this T be its Lie algebra. And also on this thing, there is an action of a certain finite group, W, which is called the Weyl group. So for example, when G is SLN, this is just the G. G is SLN, then W is just a symmetric group. And T is just C star, well, it's isomorphic to C star to the, well, it's C star to the, it's collection of all elements x1, xn in C star to the n, such that the product of xi is equal to 1. And so in general, H star G of a point, this is the algebra of, this is the algebra of polynomial functions on on T, so which can be thought of as symmetric algebra just on the vector space T star. So this is the polynomial functions on T, which are also doubly invariant. So these are polynomial functions on T mod W. So in this case, T is just one-dimensional and W is trivial. So we get polynomial functions on just one-dimensional space. In general, we're going to get something like this. So, in general, for any x and for any action, the equivariant cohomology, I'm not going to define it, but it's usual cohomology is just a vector space. But this cohomology is a module over equivariant cohomology of a point. So what this means is that now assume that x is smooth and compact. So in fact, in practice, none of these assumptions will be true, but let's assume that x is smooth and compact. And for a smooth and compact space, you can actually integrate, over smooth and compact space, you can integrate cohomology classes. And then suppose you have some alpha in which is in this equivariant cohomology class. And then it makes sense to integrate this alpha over x. And usually when you integrate, you get a number, but here, the rules of the game are such that all the quantities are not numbers, but they're elements in here. So it's actually going to be an element in this thing, which is a function, which means that it's a function on T star mod W. So for example, if this group G is really a circle, then this will be just a function of one variable. And if this group is, say, n-dimensional torus, this is going to be a function of of n variables. And if for general G, it will be somehow, if the dimension of the maximal torus is n, it's going to be a function of n variables, but also it should be invariant under certain finite group. Yes?
So can I think of alpha as a form valued in the...
Yeah, so there is a way to think about this, is that when you write it in terms of sort of, when you think about cohomology as Dirac cohomology, then there is a model for this when you actually think about this as differential forms which actually depend on certain parameters.
So you integrate it and it gives you an element.
I'm sorry?
You integrate it and it gives you an element of the dual.
No, you can just define. I mean, just the question is, I mean, I haven't defined for you this equivalent cohomology. So there are various definitions. So one of the definitions is, but is there's a Dirac model for this. So when you write sort of cohomology of certain complexes of differential forms, but these differential forms are actually the way you write the complex is that you write differential forms which depend on the same parameters. And then somehow everything just to sort of put the dependence on these parameters into the complex, which defines the cohomology. And then it's not a surprise that when you integrate, then you still have dependence on the same parameters. So making this, so this idea of Nekrasov put a little bit more precisely is that, but again, still not precisely enough, is that one should, well, so one should define certain quantities in gauge theory, such as, for example, partition function of gauge theory and certain correlation functions as well. Actually, partition function of gauge theory. And by the way, gauge theory, there can be various different gauge theories. There can be gauge theory, there can be pure gauge theory, there can be gauge theory of certain matter, so that is all sort of should be a part of this, should be defined by as a generating function of integrals of some. So let me write a sentence and then I'll a little bit spell out what are the players here of some cohomology classes. So first of all, I'll comment what kind of cohomology classes we should be talking about. Of some cohomology classes over this MDG, and so everything should be equivariant with respect to G cross GL2. Now let me explain several things here. So first of all, the first idea is that some cohomology class, the actual gauge theories which can be treated in this way, these are n equal to supersymmetric gauge theories. Now there are many such theories somehow. So it depends what kind of matter we put into the theory. And so that actually is reflected by what cohomology classes you're integrating. So what kind of gauge theory you consider. So you're working with the same modular spaces, the same cohomology, but what actual cohomology classes you pick up, this depends on what gauge theory you pick up. This idea number one. The second idea is that we do things equivariantly, so we get things which depend on some parameters. So let me introduce some notation here. So this is, so result, depends on parameter, let me call it A. This is kind of standard notation, which lives in T mod W. And some variables epsilon 1, epsilon 2. So here, which are just complex numbers. So this is somehow, these are the equivalent parameters which have to do with the group G, and these are the ones which have to do with the group GL2. So note that in GL2, the maximal torus is just C2 squared, and its Lie algebra is just C2. So we get just functions on C2, but they also should be symmetric with respect to epsilon 1, epsilon 2. And so this is actually the space of this A is responsible for properly understood for permutation of properly understood space of vacuum of this theory. And these are the extra parameters. So this is this omega by ground. These are extra parameters. So these are the things which eventually will allow to regularize things. So this is this omega by ground that I talked about. Now, this is kind of very roughly the idea. And also, the cohomology itself, the Icarian cohomology itself, is of interest from this point of view, because it's supposed to be a good part of the Hilbert space of this theory. So this should be actually the cohomology should actually be identified with the space of what's called BPS states. But let me talk about this later. Now I just want to address one problem. Problem is that this MDG is actually smooth, but it's not compact. So we need a compactification. Now, first of all, it turns out that in this generality, you can actually drop the compactness assumption, and replace it by a weak assumption, which will still be not satisfied here, but it will be satisfied after a certain modification. So you can drop the compactness assumption in the following way. So let me again choose a maximal torus T in G. So it turns out that if the space of fixed points with respect to T is compact, then all integrals are still defined. Then integral of any cohomology class is well defined. But there's some small price you have to pay for this. I said that the result is a function on this, actually on T mod W, T star mod W, is a function on T mod W. It's here it's actually a polynomial function. But here you're going to have a rational function as a rational function. On. So you have to allow certain denominators, and then this condition turns out to be sufficient. Now you can ask whether this holds here, and this turns out that this holds here, but in some form which is too strong, namely here, and then no fixed points at all. And this formalism works in such a way that if there are no fixed points, then all integrals are zero. So somehow you don't get anything interesting, but you have to enlarge the space a little bit. And so there's a canonical partial compactification of this space, which I'll denote by UDG. And this is called the Uhlenbeck space. And it's actually pretty hard to define it. It's very easy to explain what it looks like kind of as a set. And it's just a disjoint union of all d prime less or equal than d and greater or equal than 0. So here you should put instantons of smaller charge. But also you need a bunch of points in C2. So this symbol means that you have just this many points in unordered points in C2. So the way you should think about this is that you allow sort of some kind of degenerate instantons. And so these are the points where these degenerations occur. If you allow this many degenerations, then in addition, you also need a non-degenerate instanton, but with a smaller charge. That's sort of standard thing in this business. But actually defining this as a space, sort of gluing these things together is a non-trivial task. So far, what's written on the right-hand side is just a set. And to define it as some actual space and bet as some algebraic variety is actually a non-trivial thing. But you know, it's known that this can be done. And so now it turns out that, if you take this UDG and then you take the maximal torus of G times C star squared, this consists of just one point. So you can integrate cohomology classes. Which is not actually something I'm not going to do in this talk, because I want to actually concentrate on cohomology itself. And like I said, so I want to concentrate on cohomology itself, but the problem is that the actual cohomology of this space is very poor because It has there's only one fixed point here with respect to the storage. In effect, the whole space can be contracted to this point. So this is actually a contractible space. So it doesn't have any interesting cohomology. And it turns out that there's a better thing you can do. And one thing I want to say right away, that this is always highly singular. That's another problem that somehow, so I said that you can integrate cohomology classes, but in fact, so far you can't because this space is highly singular. So somehow we cure the compactness problem, the price we have to pay for this is that we get a singular space. And so here, there are, again, different approaches how we can work with this. So somehow the most naive approach is that whenever you have a singular space, you have to resolve the singularities and work with a smooth space. First of all, sometimes you can do this, but in general, in this generality, you can't really do this. And you can do it only for some particular choices of groups. And in general, I don't somehow like this approach. I think that in some sense, singular spaces are much more interesting than smooth spaces. I guess that in mathematics, there's a replacement. In the case, when you work with singular spaces, there is a replacement for cohomology, which is kind of adequate for singular spaces. And this is what is called the intersection cohomology. Again, I don't have time or resources to explain what it is now, but let me just say that it's a replacement of usual cohomology for singular spaces. So it's for singular, it's usually defined for algebraic varieties. It has the following, its main sort of property is that it's, first of all, for smooth space, you get the same thing as before. But also, although it's defined for singular spaces, it satisfies Poincaré duality, which has Poincaré duality. And if you think a little bit about this, the fact that you have Poincaré duality. It implies that you can integrate cohomology classes. So kind of conclusion is the following. If you have, let X be any complex algebraic variety. So by any, I mean that not necessarily smooth with a G action. Such that the set of fixed points with respect to the torus is compact. Then, first of all, it makes sense to consider, so I'll denote this intersection cohomology by IH star of G is, defined. For this, you don't need this assumption. It's always defined whenever you have any space for the G action, any variety of the G action. But what's important is that for any alpha in this intersection cohomology, whatever it means, you can associate an integral of alpha over X. And this is a rational function in T with W. I want to talk actually about cohomology itself, not about these integrals, but let me just sort of conclude this I don't have too much time left, so let me just say that, for example, how this is applied. So for example, to define certain partition functions in gauge theory, for example, if you want to define the Nekrasov partition function of let's say, pure n equal to a supersymmetric gauge theory. So pure means that we'll have to integrate just the unit cohomology class. So here, again, I don't have time to explain what this intersection cohomology is, but it always contains usual cohomology inside. And in particular, it makes sense to talk about the unit cohomology class. So, and this thing is defined as a generating function of integrals of unit cohomology classes. And so this is a function of the parameters A, epsilon 1, epsilon 2, and this Q. And so, okay. So like I said, this epsilon 1, epsilon 2 can be thought of as auxiliary parameters, and A and Q are certain parameters which should exist in this gauge theory from the very beginning, but let me not go into this. And so more precisely, this is what is called the instanton part of the partition function. There's also some other simple part which is called the perturbative part, but the kind of interesting part of the partition function is this one. So the conclusion is that you really have to, if you want to be able to define this quantity, you really have to know what this equivariant intersection cohomology is. There's no, again, so for groups like SUN, you can get away by choosing sort of some kind of clever resolution of singularities of this space. But if you care, for example, about the group A8, I don't know whether people here care about the group A8, but if somebody by some chance cares about the group E8, then the only, well, actually, even if you work with symplectic or orthogonal groups, then the only way to, known to me way to define these things would be to go through this business. And it's even worse if you want to work not with pure gauge theory, but with gauge theory with some matter, because in that case, you will have to integrate not the unit cohomology class, but some kind of more complicated cohomology classes. And so this will be really some kind of elements in this. So see, unit cohomology class, something you can, which makes sense in the usual cohomology. And the usual cohomology here is just much, much smaller. But this intersection cohomology, it contains sort of, it's much bigger than the usual cohomology, and sort of it contains all the relevant cohomology classes that you need in order to define this partition function.
This can be done explicitly?
Well, it depends what you mean by saying explicitly. So in some sense, it cannot be done explicitly. You can't write any, I mean, again, it's a question of background. So somehow, it cannot be done explicitly in the sense that I don't think you can write any kind of explicit combinatorial formulas for the answer. But in some sense, I don't want to do this. Because, I mean, I think it's more interesting to relate it to some other things without computing them somehow. I mean, somehow when you prove that two things are the same by computing both of them independently, I don't think this is interesting. It's interesting that if you have two complicated things, it's interesting to relate them without actually computing them.
So you want to relate this to some
to some quantity? Yes. Yes. Exactly. Okay. So.
And you don't really care what the number is.
I'm sorry.
You don't really care what.
No, well, it's not. Well, first of all, it's not a number. It's just it's a function of many parameters. But you see, sometimes even if you can write some implicit formulas for this. So, for example, in case of unitary gauge group, you can write some explicit formulas for each of those integrals, and you get some which is kind of pretty complicated combinatorial formulas. But this it doesn't help you to relate it to something else, because somehow you get some kind of explicit combinatorial formula, and then you want to relate it to some other quantity, and you need to see this how this explicit combinatorial formula appears on the other side, and this is.
Is there the same kind of Bonnet version for the CFT?
In the CFT, it's already there somehow.
So
these parameters are already. So you'll okay. So now let me go. I have something like 10 minutes, so let me go to the CFT side. I guess this is number 3 in my list. This is now formally, in order for everything I'm saying to be true, I need to make some assumption about the group G still. So I'll assume that G is what is called simply least. I mean, just to be able to relate the two sides, I'll need to make this assumption. So it means that G is of ADE type. So in fact, you can do it for all groups, but then some slight modifications are needed. So let me just make the assumption for safety. And so it's not necessary for everything I'm going to say, but for some of the things I'm going to say, it will be necessary. So then, the claim is that the same quantities and the same actually and even this cohomology itself. So maybe I should also write it here that this, if I consider the direct sum of all these cohomologies with the relevant structures, for example, with Poincaré pairing and so on, this is expected to be the space of BPS states in, again, in equal to Susan Gage theory. Now, maybe one comment I need to make about this is that this intersection cohomology might seem to be a kind of very mysterious object, but usually you can think about this in terms of L2 cohomology with respect to certain correctly chosen metric. So by L2 cohomology, I mean just the cohomology of the Durham complex where all differential forms somehow are supposed to lie in L2. So there's some condition on on what happens with the differential forms at the singularities. So I mean, you work with differential forms on the smooth part, but impose certain conditions about behavior near the singularities. Okay, so now the CFT which appears here is what is called the Toda field theory. And so, for example, the simplest example is when G is SL2, this is what is called the Liouville theory. And so I'm not going to talk about the conformal field theory itself, but instead I want to talk a little bit about the algebra which governs this theory. So which algebra governs this theory. So if G is SL2, this question is relatively simple. So the relevant algebra is the Virasoro algebra. This is the Virasoro algebra, so which is the central extension of the algebra of vector fields in a circle. And so this is the algebra which is sort of it's actually some, in this case, it's a Lie algebra, and it's a Lie algebra which is sort of generated by, so it has some standard generators, Li, where you should think about Li as, this is just z to the power I d over dz, so I guess this h1 to put here, I plus 1. And there are some standard commutation relations. So somehow it's, there's also the center. The center is just one-dimensional. And so the commutation relations are just commutation relations between those vector fields, but also there's some formula for the central extension, which I'm not going to write on the board. What's important for me is that its representations depend on, it has a representations which depend on two parameters. So it's, I'll say this for arbitrary group in a minute, but let me just say that one can introduce a module over M lambda k. This is what is called the Verma module over the Virasoro algebra, which is characterized by the following condition. So it is it's generated by one kind of vacuum vector, which I'll denote like this, and which satisfies the condition that Li is applied to lambda equal to zero if I is greater than zero. And so lambda here, lambda and k here are just numbers. And so k is the central charge. Central charge for this, so it depends on what kind of central extension we consider. And lambda is just characterized by the eigenvalue of L naught. So I get this family of modules which depend on two parameters. So they depend on two parameters and, just two numbers. And they have also some, they have certain structures. So for example, you can try, let me not go into too many details, but for example, there's a certain bilinear form that you can define. Each of these modules carries a certain bilinear form, which later on will be related to the Poincaré pairing on the cohomology. And so let me just formulate the statement I want to formulate in the case of SL2. So I want to compare this M lambda k. So we want to compare M lambda k with the cohomology, with the direct sum of the of this equivariant intersection cohomologies. I need to put the Uhlenbeck spaces. And so G, again, my G is just SL2 in this case. And the claim is that you can actually identify one with the other. So the theorem in the case of SL2 is saying that, let me formulate it in the following way. So theorem for SL2 there exists a natural action of the Virasoro algebra on this direct sum. Well, in fact, again, I need to do one more thing to this. I need to, let me put here an index log, which means localized. It means that I said that this is all a module over recurring cohomology of a point. I need some localization, so I need to tensor it with the corresponding field of fractions. So I mentioned before that, for example, integrals that we want to consider, there will in the end there will be not polynomial functions of these parameters, but rational functions. And I want to sort of incorporate this into the cohomology itself. So I want to just tensor this by the corresponding field of fractions. So this is kind of a technical point, so let me just mention it and forget about this. And the point is that there's an action making it isomorphic to M lambda k. So where lambda and k, so here everything sort of depends on this parameters A, epsilon 1, and epsilon 2. And so this M lambda k, lambda and k are certain explicit functions of A, epsilon 1, epsilon 2, which I don't want to write because, I mean, this is some simple functions, but just it's not, I think, very relevant. So just, in some sense, so here everything depends on three numbers. Here everything depends only on two numbers, so somehow. And so, in fact, everything here will depend only on the ratio of epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And more generally, so I have to stop now, basically, but let me just say that more generally.
Is something simplified when you take the movements, when you take the regulation?
Yeah, something simplified when what? I'm
something simplified when you take certain limits. You mentioned before that you were.
The limits that somehow, which are relevant for the original sort of work of Nekrasov, are limits when you take this epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 to 0. And this is not, that's in some sense, that's the most complicated limit. So somehow if this thing is for generic epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, they're kind of simpler than. So, but then the point is that for this, for example, this partition function, it's going to have some very bad singularities when epsilon 1 epsilon 2 equal to 0. But in fact, you can sort of describe what kind of. So if you take its log and multiply by epsilon 1 epsilon 2, then there will be a limit. And then the theorem is that now if you put in this setting, epsilon 1, epsilon 2 equal to 0, you recover what is called the Zeiber-Witten prepotential of this theorem. And this is actually, I mean, somehow the whole point of this original work of Nekrasov was that this was a way to, Zeiber-Witten prepotential is described kind of, it has a rigorous mathematical definition in terms of a certain iterable system. And the claim is that it sort of appears in gauge theory, but there was no kind of mathematical rigorous formulation of what it means. So how to sort of mathematically get it from the gauge theory. And this was the way to do it. But somehow, this theorem, which I just quoted, it's actually a non-trivial theorem. So just to prove that when you, even to prove that it has the singularities, the type of singularities to expect, is already non-trivial. And also the fact that the limit is given by the Zeiber-Witten prepotential, this is somehow a rather non-trivial theorem. But it's not exactly what I'm talking about right now. Let me just say it more generally. For arbitrary G, there is a replacement for the Virasoro algebra, which is called the W algebra. And I don't have time, so originally I was planning to say something about this, but now probably I don't have time. So for any G, one can define certain, well, for any G, and well, let's see, script G, it's Lie algebra. So everything depends only on the Lie algebra. One can define certain algebra, which is called the W of G. So it's not a Lie algebra anymore. Mathematically, it's what is called the vertex operator algebra. And so physically, it's exactly what you need to define sort of, it's exactly what you get from conformal field theory. So this sort of algebra, I mean, it's generated by certain fields, and you kind of know what the operator product expansion for this field, for the products of the fields is. So this is basically, mathematically, the structure is formalized by this words vertex operator algebra. So this is an algebra which sort of governs this toward the field theory. So it's a replacement for Virasoro, which is the double algebra of Pressel 2. And again, the theorem then will be that there exists some, this W of G acts on the same cohomology. So X means that we can actually construct this action. And moreover, I don't have time to explain this, but the point is that this action satisfies certain list of expected properties. So for example, the resulting module over this algebra is something you can describe what kind of module you get. It's also some kind of Fermi module. And also here, there are some geometric structures on this side. So for example, there's a Poincaré pairing, and it goes over to some algebraically defined pairing on the Sverma modules. And also, for example, if you want to understand this Nekrasov partition function, then you, so here you have this unit cohomology classes. So let me talk about the Virasoro case. So you have this here, the unit cohomology classes, they become certain particular vectors or particular states in this, in here. And you can also describe what they are. So somehow it will take me some time to do this. But the point is that the things that you want to, I mean, you can actually sort of describe the things that you want to integrate. And also, let me just also mention that integral is nothing else. What does it mean to actually integrate certain cohomology class over some space? It's by definition the same as to consider its Poincaré pairing with the unit class. This is what Poincaré pairing means. And so therefore, if you know sort of the description of the Poincaré pairing on this side, and also if you know description of the unit cohomology class, this sort of basically tells you everything. So, and let me say with, so let me say that you can also match the corresponding structures. Structures on both sides. And so somehow, let me just finish by saying that this space should be thought of, when you can vary all the, both this lambda and k, it should be thought of as a Hilbert space for this Liouville theory, which is maybe the holomorphic part of this Hilbert space. And this space should be thought of as the space of BPS states for the corresponding four-dimensional gauge theory. And in this way, what you do is that you identify the space of BPS states in the four dimensions. We say holomorphic part of the Hilbert space in two dimensions. This is some kind of relation between this four-dimensional and two-dimensional theory. And the point is that you can also do it for arbitrary group, which is sort of technically is much more complicated than for SL2, but you can do it. And get some corollaries about some kind of partition functions like here. But I guess I have to stop.
So your answer to your question is yes, that you can define a rigorous correspondence?
No, the answer is no, because you see, I remember that when I was a student, I asked my advisors, what is quantization? Mm-hmm. And his answer was that the word quantization is similar to the word love, that somehow everybody talks about it, and somehow everybody thinks that he knows what he or she knows what it means, but somehow at the same time everybody understands this is not the true quantization. So I think that same thing happens here in the following sense, that somehow what I said is definitely corollary of the true correspondence, but somehow the true correspondence is much richer than this is. So for example, you see, okay, so let's think on the CFT side. So let's consider this SL2 example when we have this Liouville theory, which is kind of understandable. So this Liouville theory is supposed, you know, just as basically any conformal field theory, it's supposed to have a lot of correlation functions. So, and correlation functions depend on the following. You should pick a Riemann surface, a bunch of points on the Riemann surface, and then you should pick, you should also put this each lambda for every point. And then given that, you're supposed to basically get a number. So all of these quantities are supposed to have, you're supposed to be able to recover all of these quantities in terms of gauge theory. Now, what I'm saying here is some very, very special case of this. In fact, some very, very degenerate case of this. So this is all, first of all, has to do with the fact that the situation when the Riemann surface is a sphere, but also there are no points here with there are no points with this lambdas here. So this is, I mean, the original AGT correspondence was talking about, it was actually some slightly different version of this, and it had to do with the case when it had a sphere and four points with, and then there was a statement that it can be written as a similar partition function, but then you should really, it has to do with the gauge theory with matter really for And for example, this thing I was talking about here, you can get it as a limit of that partition function. So somehow, but in general, what is expected, and I think for SL2, you can really probably formulate as this, that somehow when you start with any correlation function on the CFT side, you can write certain partition function of this sort on the gauge theory side, such that they are supposed to be equal. So even for SL2, this is not, first of all, not known. But at least for SL2, it's, I think there is an understanding at least how this works. I mean, what is equal to what? I think that for general G, there is an expectation that, so somehow you see this whole argument works that it all goes, I mean, you get some relation between four-dimensional theory and two-dimensional theory. Why do we get it? It has to do with the fact that there is some kind of six-dimensional theory where you can embed both, and somehow this, so six is four plus two, so we can, it allows you to go from between four and two dimensions. And, but this is kind of, this is in some sense a philosophical remark. So if you want to actually say how this works precisely, it's not completely clear. So I don't think that for a general G, there's a formulation even on the physical language, what should be equal to what. So there's a kind of expectation that whatever reasonable question you ask on one side, should have an interpretation in terms of the other side. But how exactly this works, this is not clear. So what I described here, you can think about this as, I mean, if you want some relation between two theories, then you, as a first step, you want to identify the Hilbert spaces, or at least maybe not the full Hilbert spaces, but some parts of the Hilbert spaces. So this is what this is about. But now, in addition to the Hilbert spaces, you want to sort of say something about correlation functions, and this I don't know how to do. And I think that, and this is not a problem of making things rigorous, because somehow I think that even in the non-rigorous language, this is not done either. So. No, it's not a complete surprise, but there's a, so, okay, so secretly, the reason I started thinking about this had nothing to do with physics, and somehow, and it's all, somehow I arrived at this from a completely different angle, which has to do with geometric Langlands correspondence, but I certainly don't have time now to start talking about this, so this is a, so it sounds as no, it's not a surprise, at least, you know, this thing is not a surprise, let me say it like that.
So from the geometric Langlands,
well, yes, it's not, I mean, unfortunately, it's not exactly as simple as that, because geometric Langlands correspondence would be some kind of baby version of this, so somehow, I mean, there's actually, I mean, this statement is not, it's kind of not unique in the sense that you can embed it into a whole series of similar statements. And then in the series of similar statements, there are some, there's some subset which is kind of much simpler than the other, and so for it's a series, so here, the algebra which appears, I mean, I'm talking about this statement. The algebra which appears as a W algebra, but under, somehow in the series, there will be many other algebras which appear here. So for example, the affine Lie algebra itself can appear there, or even just the finite dimensional algebra G can also appear there. So somehow, the point is that for a certain least of algebras, you can realize their representations as on certain cohomology. And for some of those algebras, this is not surprising in the sense that this is a part of this whole geometric Langlands package. But so this is formally not a part of the geometric Langlands package, but it's kind of analogous to something that you kind of that you can understand in the framework of geometric Langlands. That's more or less my motivation.
Is it part of the more general
Langlands? You would hope so, but it's not done. It should be. It's exactly something that I some kind of project I was involved in for the last maybe 10 years, trying to generalize. It should have something with Langlands correspondence, but for infinite dimensional groups. Which is something that there's no good formulation for it, but I mean, the reason this is interesting for me is that it's actually that I kind of hope that this is part of this geometric Langlands for infinite dimensional groups, which I don't know exactly what it is.
So it might be a clue eventually as to how to make that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not sure it's a clue. It's eventually, if somebody comes up with the right formulation, it will be a corollary of that. I'm not sure this will actually help you to.
Let's thank Alexander.